can hear the mountain behind me rumbling. There's an enormous mud and water slide came down and washed out the road.
That's local TV cameraman David Crockett scrambling to escape unimaginable devastation.
My God, this is hell. I just can't describe it. It's pitch black. Just pitch black. This is hell on earth I'm walking through.
In Seattle that day, 150 kilometers from the volcano, university student Peter Frenzen watched the eruption unfold on TV. 30 years later, Frenzen is the staff scientist for the Mount St. Helens National Volcanic Monument. The park preserves portions of the blast zone for scientific studies. Other parts are open for public recreation.
We're actually standing on what was the top and the insides of Mount St. Helens. The original surface here would be about 150 feet to 200 feet below us. So if we had been here on May 17th, 1980, we would have been, you know, drifting over the landscape about 150 to 200 feet in the air.
But with our feet firmly planted on the ground, we wander down one of the bucolic trails that now wind over the once charred landscape. Tall alders grow around ponds that weren't here before. Multitudes of frogs and salamanders will appear soon as it warms up. Elk hoof prints cross the way. Willows and lupins sprout on exposed hillsides.
So the change has been amazing. And one of the things I think we've learned here at Mount St. Helens is that things that initially look dead are usually anything but dead. And those things that look messy to our eye are in fact the critical ingredients of a next thriving ecosystem.
Like Frenzen, Washington State University botanist John Bishop has also spent much of his professional career in the blast zone.
What we've realized as we've spent a lot of time here and we've quantified the plants and the animals is that we actually have extraordinary levels of diversity here, of biological diversity.
More richness now, in fact, than in an old-growth forest. The patchy jumble of habitats has become a stronghold for critters otherwise in decline, such as elk, the yellow warbler, and western toad.
This recognition might lead us to be more careful as we decide what to do with disturbed areas. So it could be applied to areas that have experienced large forest fires, for example.
Of course, it's not as productive in terms of the lumber or other material you're trying to get. But in terms of the animals and plants out here, it's fundamentally more productive in terms of the diversity of the ecosystem that results.
Peter Frenzen says the human tendency is to rush in and restore or replant things. But after watching the developments on the slopes of Mount St. Helens, he and his colleagues have become believers in letting nature run its course after disaster, at least some of the time. Forest Service researcher Charlie Crisafulli and seven other scientists published a journal article to that effect this spring. It's the latest in a flurry of recent papers that try to draw wider implications from the explosion of new life at the volcano.
Lessons from Mount St. Helens have applications to wildfire, for example, but also areas that were inundated following tsunamis or from windstorms and ice storms, and even from harvesting practices or strip mines.
In fact, Crisafulli says U.S. mining industry consultants did call him recently for ideas about restoring the scraped barren landscape around closed strip mines. He told them to plant lupins because those flowers have done such a good job of creating new soil at the volcano. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi at Mount St. Helens, Washington State.